I'm really glad to have Andy here today, and he's talking about the last Capture Flag challenge from the last Chaos Communication Congress. So, I mean, we've known each other quite long, so we visit the Congress together like every year, and you're normally there doing some CTF, and I'm only there to talk and drink. So, but you're doing some really cool stuff there, and this year we talked a lot about your CTF challenge, where you built a nice challenge around mobile phones, and especially quite new ones, and so it was pretty awesome, and I guess it would be a very, very nice presentation today, having you here, Andy, and telling everything about the CTF challenge. So yeah, give some big hands for Andy, please.
Thank you. Okay, first a few words about me. Who am I? I'm Andy. When I'm not doing stuff at night, hacking stuff, I am a security researcher at Rapid7. We're doing, in the research team, we're doing internet scanning, like slash zero internet scanning, and I am doing mostly honeypot research there. You can reach me on Twitter or on IRC, usually. I am part of the CTF team called Eat, Sleep, Pwn, Repeat, or ESPR in short. We are one of the biggest German CTF teams, three teams fusioned after some time, and yeah, we have been responsible for the C3 CTF over the past few years. We've always been doing this, I don't know, I think 6 years by now, under different names like Stratomahur or whatever there is, CCCAC in the beginning. And the talk is going to be about my challenge that I did, a two-stage challenge based around GSM stuff. And during the CTF, so when I developed this, I made a video as a progress report to the other team members, and I tweeted this during the C3 CTF, and that thing went viral. Oops. That thing went more or less viral because it looked like that. What you can see in the back is all my development debug consoles and all that stuff, the different programs running, the base station running and all that stuff. And the window you can see in the middle is what I built. And it looks like a Nokia phone, but it really isn't. I built this thing completely by myself. And it's even able to talk to real phones over a GSM network. That is just to show off. I can show that later working, actually, and explain you how I did that. But the phone itself is more or less GSM compliant. The only feature it has is it can send and receive SMS and log onto a network. That's it. But that was enough work already. The story behind that is... oh, that works great. What is it doing? So yeah, as I said, I always wanted to build a GSM challenge. The problems I had was I didn't know shit about GSM. Of course, I played around with it because there were open source tools available, but I didn't really know anything about the inner workings of it. Like, how is an SMS sent from A to B? I set up a GSM base station, sure, and it worked. But as soon as I encountered some kind of problem, I was just not able to properly debug it because I didn't know enough about it. Also, as I said, the inner protocols, no idea about that. The C3 CTF has the problem that remote teams need to be able to participate. Teams all around the world want to play, and I cannot just set up a GSM network using RF, because then it would only be locally available, and there are regulatory problems because I would need a license for that and all that kind of stuff. Then the question is, what should I implement? I can't build everything from scratch. I can't build a base station and a baseband and the UI and everything from scratch. So in the beginning, in the 31st C3, I built a similar challenge, which already used the UI code that I wrote. But that was much simpler. This is a video from the Polish Dragon Sector team where you can see the thing booting. What that was is... you log on via Telnet, and then you see a text UI that resembles a Nokia phone. And Oh, this is actually the exploit already. Yeah, but it looks like a Nokia phone. And there was a bug. This is the SMS editor. You can see that there is some text being written there. And the bug there was that you could fill up the SMS space with 160 characters, and then you can add a template and add additional 160 characters into that buffer, which would overflow the buffer, and you would exploit this. And what you can see here, this garbage that shows up on the screen is the shellcode that is being written into that buffer, which contains the exploit, essentially. And that you get a shell. There is a small command prompt in the bottom, and there's the shell. This was the first iteration of that challenge. And now it's back to weirdness again. This thing didn't have a real baseband. It didn't do any GSM stuff. There were two CPUs in a virtual environment, the first one running the UI using the Telnet ASCII art interface, and the second one was the baseband, which wasn't really a baseband. It was just some firmware running, and the UI talked to this over some shared memory interface, and you could send SMS, and the SMS would be printed on a serial port. That's it. And then I found OsmoCom and VirtualUM. OsmoCom is a project, I think it stands for Open Source Mobile Communications. Harald Welter started that years ago when he reverse engineered a GSM base station. And out of that efforts, he founded a company, and he's doing all kinds of open source GSM stack and UMTS stack work there. VirtualUM is the solution for our RF problem. These people need to do unit tests. And because they can't, for every unit test, spin up a real base station, they replaced the RF layer with UDP multicast traffic. So instead of sending traffic over an RF interface, it's being sent over UDP multicast traffic in one direction, and the base station would send it to the phone, like broadcast it to all the participants in the network, and the phones would broadcast everything over a multicast channel back to the base station for the other direction. This is a block diagram of a typical OsmoCom-based phone network containing GSM and UMTS. On the right side, you can see the core network. We don't really need to care about this. It contains the mobile switching center, which does all the call routing. It contains the Osmo HLR, which saves the subscriber data, like the crypto keys and your identity, your phone number. So if you log in, the network knows who you are. And on the left side, usually, the core network just exists once per network, per provider. There is, of course, some redundancy. If the HLR would break, then you wouldn't have any possibility to log onto the network anymore. So that's there multiple times, but it's one big entity in general. And then on the left side, you have the radio access network, and this is usually there multiple times. The lower blue box, the H node B, is for UMTS. We don't need to care about that because we are not using any UMTS. Then there is the Osmo H node B gateway. That's the interface from the UMTS base station, which is the H node B to the core network. And then on the top there is Osmo BTS. BTS stands for base transceiver station. This is what does all the RF. This is what you mount on a cell phone tower and attach antennas to. And then there is the Osmo BSC, which is the base station controller, and this is kind of like the zookeeper for all of the base transceiver stations you have, because you might have multiple of them on a radio pole, and that's where the word cell comes from. Every cell or multiple cells even are controlled by the base station controller. And all of this stuff is available in open source. You can just download it, compile it. There are even Debian packages by now, so you can just install it if you have the right hardware on a Debian-based Linux system. This is what I'm usually using if I'm using real phones with my GSM network. I set one up here in this small ARM box. It's just an Odroid that I had lying around. It doesn't even need to be that powerful. Because I don't have a GSM base station at home, people came up with nice ideas just to use software-defined radios. I have one here. This is a Lime SDR. It looks pretty normal. I just build a black box around it because it just comes as a PCB. And so you have the Lime SDR on the left, and as a bridge between the base transceiver station and the software-defined radio, you have something that's called Osmo TRX. TRX stands for transceiver, and this is what takes GSM radio bursts, like small traffic packets essentially, modulates them so that you can send it over and over an antenna and communicates with a software-defined radio to transmit this over the air. And then there are phones like a old school Nokia 3310, 3330, whatever, or special ones like the Motorola one you have here. I also brought one, bought some on eBay, which is nice because this one, on this one, you can run an alternative firmware with an open source phone stack, and also made by the Osmocom people. And that's how you would build a GSM network at home. You just need to be a bit careful where you're transmitting, and you don't make it leave the room because you would disturb other people. And it's illegal usually to transmit on these bands. In the case of the challenge, we are replacing that whole radio infrastructure with a GSM tab multicast thing. The cloud I drew in there in that diagram is just some random network. It might be a VPN, it might be just some local network, whatever. And then there is this VertFi thing, which replaces the RF layer and uses UDP multicast to transmit traffic around. And then you can attach Osmocom BB again, and then you have a phone on the network. Of course, you can't use real phones because they do RF. You can't tell them to transmit UDP multicast. So you need to have a custom solution for that. But for unit tests, that's fine because you need you need to control all the different components anyway. And you would write your test case some way, control Osmocom BB, run your test cases, and then observe log output, crashes, whatever your unit testing involves. You can also combine these two just by starting a second base transceiver station. So you have one doing the UDP multicast stuff. You add a second one. You tell the base station controller, hey, you are now controlling two base transceiver stations. And then you would add the second one, which talks to the software-defined radio, and the first one, which does the UDP multicast stuff, which I also set up here, so I can show that in a minute. Okay, so we solved the first two problems. I know stuff about GSM now because I had to set up everything and I can look at that stuff. Wireshark has some nice dissectors for that UDP multicast thing. It's called GSM tap. That's the equivalent to radio tap headers if you ever sniffed Wi-Fi. In monitor mode on Linux, you get the Wi-Fi packets encapsulated in something called radio tap. Which contains meta information like what network it belongs to, what was the signal strength of that packet, all that kind of stuff. And GSM tap is equivalent because the problem, it contains different metadata because GSM is time slot based and there are no source and destination addresses like in TCP/IP. And the source and destination of a packet or burst called in GSM is implicit by the time when it was sent. Okay, so what should I implement? And I can't build everything from scratch. I still have the UI code, so it was clear that I wanted to build a phone because the GSM network, yeah, I mean, usually if you're a hacker and you want to attack some targets, you would want to attack a phone. I already have the UI code from 31C3, so I figured I would just use that. I can edit SMS already, so I can edit them, send them, receive them, all that kind of stuff is there. I then added FBDev graphics instead of the Telnet ASCII art thing. I just added FBDev graphics and libSDL. LibSDL for my local development efforts because it was easier just to have a small window with the UI in. And then the idea was to run this on an ARM CPU, because traditionally phones are ARM-based. Even these Nokia phones, by the way, are ARM7-based. Big endian, by the way. It's weird, but that's the case. Okay, so we can use QEMU for that. I took QEMU and added my own hardware platform because I needed a screen, and the default platform on QEMU didn't have a screen, so I looked around and I thought I'd just use the screens the Nokia phones use as well. Because funnily enough, the Linux kernel has a driver for these. There is a subsystem called TinyFB or something like that. That's used for, I think it's still in the staging area, but it works. There are multiple backend drivers implemented for these small displays that you would hook up to a Raspberry Pi or whatever else. And these things are used by makers a lot. If they use a display, it's just an SPI interface. You can hook it up. If you have an SPI controller somewhere on some microcontroller or an application controller, you hook it up. You configure the kernel correctly, and you have a small console actually on these displays. So I implemented a QEMU backend for the display because QEMU didn't support that. Attached that to the SPI interface, configured the kernel correctly, and I had a frame buffer console, which is the reason why I implemented the FBDev backend, because that communicates with the frame buffer console, and you can draw pretty pictures on there. How do we let remote teams participate? I just created an OpenVPN network. So you could just log into an OpenVPN tunnel and you have access to the BTS because it's just IP traffic after all. Okay, the baseband, that's a problem because basebands are complicated, but there is OsmoCombiB. For these small Motorola phones. The problem with OsmoCombiB is it's not a phone. It behaves like a phone partly, but it's not a phone. It's a research tool, and it doesn't have any kind of UI graphical user interface. It just has a remote text interface, which, by the way, is modeled after the Cisco VTY interface, where you have to enter enable and so on. You will see that later. So I somehow had to take this thing apart and remove all of the debug stuff that you would use that usually for, all the text UI interfaces and so on, and I removed all of that. At least the code is somewhat layered. The goal was never to create a phone, so I had to somehow make this work. And I'm very sorry to the OsmoCom people, but I completely butchered the thing. The code is not very, very nice because I built this thing in the course of 4 to 5 weeks, and I also ran somewhat out of time as usual. So I also wanted to make phone calls work. Unfortunately, the UDP layer doesn't support traffic channels where the voice would go over. So I removed that in the end. So I ripped out the complete call support in OsmoCombiB. And also, I needed to rely on ready-made stuff because the CTF goes over the course of 48 hours, and I can't expect teams to completely reverse engineer a GSM stack in that time span. They are perfectly capable to do that, but not in 48 hours. And to do that, I split the UI and the baseband into two different processes and made these things talk to each other over a Unix socket. So you have one process for the baseband, which then over another socket talks to the lowest GSM layer, which does the UDP stuff, and then you have another socket from the baseband to the UI where UI events go over. For example, hey, you received an SMS. Here is the raw SMS payload, and then the UI parses this, writes it into SQLite database because that was the convenient thing to do, and it shows on the screen that you received a new SMS. Same goes for network events. You got network connectivity or you lost network connectivity, stuff like that. As I said, I butchered OsmoCombiB, removed the call support, the CLI support, added the socket interface, tied UI events to it. There was already something they called primitives because they have a Lua scripting interface there, which you can use to write scripts to send bulk SMS and so on. For example, if you have been to a congress and you were on the GSM network, you might have gotten some SMS involuntarily. I would guess that people used exactly that stuff for it. You can also do this with Nokia phones, but that is just to write some Lua scripts. And these primitives they used for this were somewhat usable for that socket interface as well. Essentially, I'm just passing around union structs. For every event, I have a struct in a union and then a type in the front which says, okay, this event is an SMS, this event is a network event, this is, I don't know, shutdown request for the software to exit, all that kind of stuff. And I got a phone. It was a lot of work. I got all of this, as I said, 3, 4, 5 weeks on and off. I had to work during the day, and I had a bunch of sleepless nights before Christmas. On the journey to the C3, I added the bugs and started writing the exploits. On day zero, I built the ROP chain for the shellcode together with Niklas. And on day one, I deployed everything on our infrastructure because we had some servers where the challenges are supposed to be run, and I had to, so that not everybody was able to start GSM base stations, because every team which wanted to play needed their own GSM base station. We needed some infrastructure where you click on a button, it would start a GSM base station, or add you into a queue if enough base stations were running already, because we don't have unlimited resources to run that stuff. But at the end of, during day one, everything was deployed and the CTF started on day one, so it wasn't too bad. Okay, so problem solved. Everything ready. Now, I also needed a SIM card. I had the phone, but I didn't have the SIM card. I looked around and I didn't find any kind of open source SIM card implementations. I decided to implement my own one in another process, and it implements the real APDUs for communication. An APDU is just a byte string that goes to a smart card or comes from a smart card. This interface is standardized, and every smart card, your banking card, your whatever card, implements this APDU interface. And on top of that, you have an application layer with different messages that implement different things. And all of that for GSM is standardized in GSM 11.11. That's the specification. You can download on the Etsy website. And I implemented almost all of the necessary functions. So now there is an open source SIM card, if you would like to call it that way. The backing store for the SIM card implements a file system. I have some slides for that as well. It's just a JSON file, because I needed to be able to edit this, and it was just convenient to just use a small JSON C parser and use that as a backing store. The APDUs look like that. The green boxes are a byte or multiple bytes, and this is just a byte string that you would send to a smart card. CLA stands for class. That's where magic value is in if you want to talk according to the GSM 11.11 standard. INS is the instruction, that's the opcode basically. P1 and P2 are parameters for that instruction. P3 is a bit weird, because it's, as far as I understand it, I'm not sure I did this completely right, is either a length of the payload that you attach to that PDU, to that APDU, or a length of an answer that you expect back from the SIM card. In total, there are 5 cases with different encodings available and different lengths, where the fields either are the length of the sent data or the expected data. And I think I implemented 2 of them, maybe 3, and I'm not sure if they are correct. But it worked good enough for OsmoCombB, for the GSM stack, to talk to the SIM card, so I didn't care. The response that you get back from a SIM card is payload, optionally, and then 2 status words that tell you, did the operation succeed, did it fail, what was the error code, and so on. The different instructions that GSM 11.11 specifies are select. You can select the file on a SIM card by a 16-bit integer. You can get a status response, which tells you which file is currently selected, what are the access permissions, how much free space you still have in the SIM card, all that kind of stuff. Then there is read and update binary. That's just for a binary file, you can read and update the file. You can read, update, seek, or increase record files. There are sequential files. For example, if you think about SMS, you can store 10 SMS on your phone. Then this would, with seek, you would address the record number that you would like to read, write, or update. Increase is, I think, just setting a pointer to the next entry. There are also there's also a third file type that I didn't implement because I didn't need it. I forgot what that was. And then there is a verify change, enable, disable, and unlock CHV. CHV stands for cardholder verifications. This is what usually is known as a PIN. You can verify it. That's basically entering the PIN. You can change it. You can enable or disable it. And you can unblock it. Unblock is if you enter the PIN three times wrong, then you need to unblock it with that PUK or whatever this is called in CHV speak. Yeah, and then there are a few special ones. Run the GSM algo, that's for generating crypto session keys, because the crypto key that you're using on GSM is stored securely stored on the SIM card. You can't extract it, but you can generate session keys. Every time you do a call, an encrypted call, or do some encrypted transaction, you run the GSM algo, not every time, but nowadays the specification is open. Providers were able to not run this every time and reuse the session key because the SIM card expires after a while. You can only run this crypto operation for a certain amount of times. And providers wanted to save, SIM cards, essentially, because if that is depleted, that amount of times you can run the algorithms, then you would need a new SIM card. Due to security problems, by now they should request a new session key for every single transaction they are doing. I don't know if they really do this, but I think they do. Sleep, just sleeps. That's some smart card thing. And get response is special because if you look at the APDUs, as far as I understand it, if you send data with a payload, you set P3 to the data of the length of the payload, and then the SIM card or the smart card doesn't know how much data to send back. So what it does is it replies just with SW1 and SW2, I think. And SW1 contains, everything's fine. And SW2 contains the length of data that you can then fetch using the get response. And then you would issue another APDU with the get response instruction. And P3 would contain the length that you would like to read from the previous request to the smart card. At least that's how I implemented it. I don't know if that's correct, but yeah, it works. This is what the file structure looks like on a SIM card. The files don't really have names. They just have they have names for human readability, but they're not saved on the SIM card, as far as I know. You have a master file that's just file name 0x3f00. And then you have this tree structure where you can save the ICC ID, for example. That's an elementary file. It's just a binary file that you can read or write. And this contains the card ID. And then there is a directory file called telecom, for example. You can save stuff like the SMS center address or, I don't know, call counters, your phone number. That's mostly for informational purpose, I think. And then there is the GSM directory, which contains stuff for the network. This contains what is your home network, what is your IMSI, like your subscriber identification, all that kind of stuff. And what I implemented, for example, I think that's the least minimum that you need is the ICC ID, then the GSM subfolder, then the last used location, the phone saves which cell it used last, where it logged in, so that the network search, if you turn it on, is faster because it looks up that file, tries to find that cell on the network, and tries to log on. And if you are, for example, in a different country, that would work. So your network search would kick in, the full-blown network search, which could take a few minutes because it then needs to scan all the bands and find the new cells and all that kind of stuff. KC, for example, is the current session key for the crypto. PLMN cell is the home network. And HPLMN specifies some search interval for new cells. If you're onto a cell, I think if you're traveling around, that specifies a timeout every n minutes or seconds. It starts a scan and tries to find better cells that have stronger reception. The SIM card looks like this in the JSON. It's just a big JSON blob here. it's just a big JSON object, files, the master file table, the file type, all the constants that you see here, for example, the file type and the name and all of that stuff is according to the specification. It's just decimal because JSON doesn't support hexadecimal. Then you have the IMC file, that's file name, decimal, 28,423. File type 4 means it's an elementary file. File type 2 means it's a directory file. File type 1 means it's a master file. And then you have the values, the size and the values in there, if that thing is valid. Access conditions, we will see that later, what that means. Under which circumstances are you allowed to perform certain operations on the file? You may need to authenticate first. And these are all the different files, the location, file where it stores the last logged in location, the session key, all that kind of stuff. CHVs, that's specified in the JSON file below as part of the meta information. For example, you can see the pin 1 is 1234 in this case. You have 3 remaining tries, it's enabled, and if you are correct, reset the remaining counter to 3. And for the unblocked CHVs, that's the PUK. If you mess up if you enter the CHV 1, 2, 3 times wrong, then you would need to unblock that CHV using 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and you have 10 tries for that. If you mess that up, then your card is blocked forever, and you can throw it away. That's the theory, at least. And KI is the secret crypto key that would be used during a run GSM algo. It gets a challenge response, I think a nonce and all that kind of stuff, and then the A5 comp 128 V whatever algorithm runs on the SIM card and generates the session key, which is then saved in that KC file here. Cardholder verification, as I said, is the PIN. If CHV1 is enabled, the SIM is locked after reset, and every transaction, if you would like to read a file, would tell you it's blocked, you need to enter CHV1. And then you would do the verify CHV1, and you gain more privileges. And the standard access levels for file operations are either CHV1, CHV2, ADM, which stands for administration. That's a special one if you provision SIM cards, for example, or always, which is without any kind of authentication. Okay, so we got a phone now. The environment that I gave to the teams looked like this. We have the QMU, and in that QMU we have that FB dev device, and which is responsible for key input and the screen. And we have the networking layer, which is just OpenVPN, which gets started, and you get access to the base station UDP multicast network. In between, in the middle, we have the baseband. The baseband communicates over something that's called trust zone interface with the SIM card, because the SIM card lives in a trust zone environment. What this is, I'll have a slide later. Then there is a socket for the UI and the baseband to talk to each other, and a socket for layer 1, the GSM layer 1, and the baseband to talk to each other. The phone. Okay, now starts the fun part. This, as I said, this is my GSM base station. If I plug this in here, I can start it. Disclaimer, this RF doesn't leave the room, I checked before. So now I started the transceiver. The transceiver talks to the core network now, and if I turn on this phone, it should get a network. This is the upper one is the thing that talks to the software-defined radio. So that was the first GSM based transceiver station, which uses the SDR, is now online, and this phone should work. Now on the bottom terminal, I am going to start the virtual. Oh, I'm way too close to the radio; it's clipping. On the bottom terminal, I can start the virtual. The virtual BTS, that's running as well, and I should see multicast traffic. If I now go into my development environment for the phone, I just compiled everything to run on my x86 notebook. That's how I mainly develop this stuff. I can just start layer one, I can start the baseband, I can start the SIM card, and I can start the UI. And then you see the phone that starts up. I enter the PIN, and now you can see a bunch of messages flowing around, and it already has a network. On the top left side, you can see the GSM bursts that are sent using UDP multicast. On the top right, you see stuff that's going on in the baseband on the higher protocol layers. On the top left, I see some debug output from the SIM card. You can see that, for example, I'm getting APDUs, I'm replying to them, and so on. On the top right, on the bottom right, you can see some debug output of the UI. Now this is what the thing looks like. It resembles a phone of famous manufacturer back in the 90s. The only thing it can do is send and receive messages, and you have a phone book. If I were to write a message now, so this phone has phone number 1004. If I send an SMS to 1004, this is what you saw on the earlier video. We should receive a message shortly. On this phone. Yeah. I can also reply, of course, because why not? This thing doesn't have T9, by the way, it's a bit cumbersome. to phone number 9999, I'm sending it now. You should see some traffic showing up there soon. Ah, yeah, there we go. And we received a message. And I can also read that, and it says, hi, C4. Yeah. Okay, that was essentially only to show off. I'm just going to stop everything. And just to be sure, remove the plug. Okay. Okay, so I got the phone. Now, where would I add bugs? The phone is only reachable via GSM. That was part of the challenge. You don't have a user interface, you have nothing. You have, and I gave the teams an environment for local development, which runs the phone in a QEMU, which it was three Docker containers in total. One ran the QEMU, one ran the complete base station with the WordFi thing, and one ran the complete, ran two Osmo Combi B phones as part of the network. So you could communicate with the target phone over GSM. The phone only has one essential feature. It's sending and receiving SMS. As you cannot interact with the UI, sending SMS is absolutely useless for you as an attacker. So something must be wrong on the receive SMS side. This is what an SMS looks like. On the highest level, SMS are just byte strings that are transmitted over some GSM channel. To be honest, I didn't even care how the inner protocol layers worked on GSM. I just looked at the application layers. All of that SMS stuff is specified in GSM 3.40, and there are different TPDUs for sending SMS, for receiving SMS, for status reports, telling the core network, hey, I received that SMS, you can remove that from your database now, all that kind of stuff. Because SMS are stored and forwarded, if you send an SMS to somebody, it is saved in the core network, and then once your phone logs on, it gets an SMS, and then it tells the phone, it tells the core network that it received the SMS and it gets purged from the queue in the core network. Okay, so interesting for our case is the SMS deliver TPDU, which is sent from the SMS service center to the phone. The first 1 to 12 bytes is the SCA, that's the, I didn't write that in the legend. Good question, what that is? The service center address, right. Then there is a PDU type. It contains a bunch of flags, what kind of TPDU that is. Is it SMS receive and so on. OA is the originating address. That's the sender address. PID is, I have no idea. Usually you just set this to 0 for a store and forward SMS. DCS is data encoding scheme. An SMS As you can see, UD, the user data, is 0 to 140 bytes, but we can send 160 bytes over an SMS. The reason for that is that you can either 8-bit encode or 7-bit encode the ASCII text. And if you use the 7-bit encoding, if you do the math, you get 160 characters. So that's specified in the data coding scheme. SCTS is the time for delivery when the SMS is I don't know which time, either the send time or the receive time, I'm not sure. UDL is the length of the following user data. So that's what the phone receives from the core network, and it needs to parse this. The standard SMS is relatively easy. You just fill out all these fields, and you can have an optional header in the user data in the end. If that header is present, you set a bit in the PDU type. If that is not present, you just don't set the bit, and you don't have that header in there. This is used for stuff like ringtones and operator logos, and SMS also support formatting. Nobody ever implemented this as far as I know, but you can have bold text, italic, and so on. And all of that stuff, you can have predefined animations, emails, all that kind of stuff. The spec is cool to read. All of these features would be configured using or specified using this user data header that is in the user data then, if that bit is set. For normal SMS, as I said, it is either 7-bit ASCII encoding or UCS2 for Unicode-like encoding. I think there are different character sets for Arabic and Turkish and all that stuff in ASCII, but you can also use something like Unicode if you do the 8-bit encoding and set the data coding scheme to UCS2. And then UDL and UD just contains the data that you want to send around. For the special SMS, as I said, there can be logos, ringtones, concatenated text, and so on. And in this case, the user data header is present to set this bit, and the data coding scheme is usually set to 8-bit. That's actually not true, I think. Because you can, yeah, that I don't, that is wrong. I think you can also set it to 7-bit. It's been a while since I implemented that. The Nokia phones, the later ones, this doesn't, but this already does, supports concatenated SMS. You could concatenate up to 3 SMS if you couldn't express yourself in 160 characters. And the way this works is exactly by using a UDO data header. That means you set this bit in the PDU type that the header is present, and then the structure in the user data looks like this. I just drew this below the user data field. UDHL is the header length that's following in bytes. IEI is the information element identifier. That's what this header describes. 0 means concatenated SMS. OXOA means it's text formatting, all that kind of stuff. And then based on the type, the following data has different lengths. So because of that, they added an information element length. In the case of concatenated SMS, that's 3, because 3 bytes are following. And then a reference number follows, the total number of parts, and the current part number of that concatenated SMS. That means in the Nokia case, if you fill up the complete SMS buffer and you would send 3 SMS, refnum would be some number so that the receiving phone can see that these 3 SMS that it received belong together. Parts would be set to 3, and part number would be set to either 1, 2, or 3. And then the payload follows. The payload can be in different data coding schemes. The interesting one is the 7-bit ASCII again, because it's 7-bit. You may need to add padding. In this case, it's 1-bit, because that is horrible to parse and horrible to build, because you have first byte-wise structured header, then you need to add padding bits to make the address in the offset in the SMS where the text starts 7-bit aligned, and then the 7-bit text follows, which might not always align with the byte boundary. So you need to shift stuff around and concatenate it and so on. Luckily enough, Osmocom, the Osmo Lib Osmo Core, it's a library from the Osmocom guys which contains a lot of parsing code and all that kind of stuff already implements almost all of this. In my case, the bug was in the SMS reassembly. That box was supposed to be an Unicode error. I guess Unicode is hard. So when the phone receives an SMS, my phone, it checks if the UDH present bit in the PDU time is set. If that's not the case, it's just going to interpret this as a normal SMS according to the data coding scheme and deliver this to the UI, or save this in the UI. The baseband forwards the raw string, like everything in green here. This string would be delivered from the baseband to the UI, and the UI would parse this. So the phone then, if it sees that there is a header, it checks the information element ID if that's type 0, that which means it's a concatenated SMS. If that's the case, the SMS gets put in a queue, identified by the reference number, until it sees that all of the parts arrived. If all arrived, it's mem copied into a buffer and it's presented to a user, like the big text that's now concatenated. If parts are missing still, it leaves it in the queue because there might be more arriving later. This is the appropriate code for that. I just a small snippet. It's the function that would be called to reassemble and deliver an SMS that was deemed to be received complete. We have a character array with 460 bytes. You can have 459 characters in a concatenated SMS with three parts in total. So the character array is 460 bytes long because of the terminating 0 byte. It's initialized with 0. Then I'm iterating over that list with the concatenated SMS parts. I am checking the data coding scheme. In the case that it's 8-bit encoding, which wouldn't fill up the complete buffer, I'm copying stuff with a memcopy into that payload buffer defined on the stack, identified by the part number times 160 bytes minus 6. The 6 bytes is because of the 6 bytes header in front of the SMS. So we would copy 136 into either in the payload at place 100 at index 0, 136, 136 times 2, and so on, based on the part number the SMS defines. Because I can't just copy it with 1, 2, 3 sequentially, because the SMS might arrive in a different order. The data is being copied from the received SMS here at the payload data at index 6, which is directly after the user data header. And the length is either the complete length minus the header, that would be this case, or the length that is in the last SMS. So if you would have the last SMS not completely full, it would just copy a chunk of that. Afterwards, it calls some DB helper function, which saves stuff and displays stuff in the UI. Now, where's the bug? Any ideas? Yeah? That is correct. The last one, if it's not completely filled up, this term here is not, so the payload length minus the header is not larger than 136. So it would use this part, which is the length in the SMS minus 6. Yeah?
But if the part number exceeds the maximum part.
Yes. The part number is not bounce checked, which means this part number can either be 1, 2, or 3. If I set this to 4, I would copy stuff at the end of this buffer. And because stacks grow downwards, I would copy behind that buffer where local variables are and the return pointer. So if I send an SMS, a concatenated SMS with, for example, part number 1, 2, and 4, then it would try to reassemble this because it received 3 SMS and the total part number was 3. And by copying the data, it would copy the first 2 SMS into this buffer and the third SMS behind that buffer and overwrite the return pointer, which upon return of that function would be overwritten, and I can point this to my ROP gadgets and get code execution that way. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I just explained. Yeah, okay, I have a demo for that. The idea behind that is I gave the teams Netcat on the target device so that they would just need to execute a program on there and get a reverse shell back. A few teams tried to send the flag back using an SMS, but that would be the nicest solution of all. But the problem is you need to keep the UI from crashing. If the UI crashes, the baseband sees that the socket is closed and you can't do any kind of GSM transactions anymore. And that caused a bunch of people problems. Also, one interesting fact is a few people, especially from China, playing remotely had problems connecting to the base station over the VPN because GSM is time critical. And if you have a lot of delay, then stuff might not arrive in time and you lose bursts. Okay. This is now what I gave the teams were a bunch of scripts to start all of that stuff. I'm going to start the base station now. That's just a Docker container and the phone, and you will see what's going on. This is the development environment I gave them with fake flags, so the flags won't be the real ones. But the environment, apart from having a compiler and everything in the QEMU image, it's completely the same. Okay. So that's the base station, and then that's the phone booting. It's going to take a while. Oh, yeah. Okay. PIN code is 1234. Hopefully it gets some network. Yeah, okay. So it has the network connectivity. It's the only phone on the network right now. I built my own Docker container with a patched Osmocom BB in there, which allows me to send my three exploit SMS that I doctored in a way that the header is what I need it to be. That's just that run script. And now I need to copy and paste some stuff because I was too lazy to put this in a script. That's just to connect to the VPN. Because all these containers don't have a direct connection, they have this VPN stuff so that you can just use this against the development environment during the CTF as you would against the final challenge. This top right window contains the vert file layer 1 for Osmocom BB. The lower left is the phone. So that's running now and it's getting network access. That output looks familiar because it's the same code I'm using essentially. And now you can Telnet onto that phone and use the Osmocom BB UI. There was a way how to maximize a window in Tmux. Does anybody know how? Yeah, Control B, I know, but yeah, whatever. I'm just going to do it that way. Okay, enable. We can see the subscribers. This is the first phone that's also on the network now. I can send SMS to the phone. We can test if that works. SMS 1 and then I can send an SMS to 9999, and then it wants some text. And that should arrive now. Yeah, okay, that works. No sound, sadly. Also no snake. That's yeah. Okay, if we look at the exploit, it's dirty. I could have made this nicer. This is the function I'm calling soon over the text user interface. I'm building this SMS header with the user data header length, the information element, which says 0 is a concatenated SMS, the payload length, the ref number, which in this case is 0x23, and three parts. And then, depending on a parameter, which is 1, 2, 3, or 4, I give it on the text UI, it's going to either send this SMS with this payload, this SMS with this payload, or this SMS with this payload. The teams I saw playing this challenge did this way nicer. They created a proper command where you could just paste hex strings into the UI and it would send this, but I was just too lazy. Yeah. Okay, we are going to have a connect back shell. So that means I need to start a netcat listener on port 1, why you would see in a minute. And so that's listening now. And I can send the SMS. I called this command exploit. I want to use phone 1 to send the exploit to telephone number 9999. Send SMS 1. So it's going to send the SMS. We need to wait a bit. Successful. Now the phone is idle again. We can send the second one. And we can send the third one. And now I need to switch fast enough to the terminal, because hopefully I'm going to get a connection. Yeah, okay. And that's the connect back shell. This is what it would look like during a CTF, and you would open a beer now. If this was a real challenge, you would find the flag here. You paste the flag into our web interface and you gain points. The exploit itself, I mean, this is pretty boring. This is just some hex strings. That's the ROP chain. This handy script here builds all of this. Niklas, thankfully, worked with me on this because he's way better at doing ROP chains. And this uses so-called gadgets from the application itself and builds a stack that executes specific, it always returns to that address, to the end of a function, and then it executes a bunch of instructions that we documented here in the comments. And in the end, what it's going to execute is this command here. This looks weird. Does anybody know what this is, that weird long number there? Yeah, it's an IP address. It's just an IP address in decimal form, because we didn't have enough space to put it in there in octet form. that's a nice trick if you have limitations in shell in code that you can execute. Also, -esh, that -e is a parameter which tells Netcat to execute a command upon a successful connection. We didn't have enough, usually you would write it that way, right? We didn't have enough space for that, so we tried some things and that works as well. Because SH is in the path and you can leave out the space. And then also port 1, why port 1? Because it's short. Okay, I'm going to leave this running because we're going to need this soon for the second stage. The second stage is the SIM card. Now, to make this a bit more challenging for the teams, usually you can't read out files on a SIM card. You can't read the crypto key, because it's a black box. You have this APDU interface, you can't do anything more. So I figured that I would put the SIM card in something that's called Trust Zone. Modern ARM CPUs have two worlds, divided in the normal world and the secure world. The normal world is where your standard operating system runs on. For example, Android with a Linux kernel and whatever. The secure world runs a so-called TEE, the Trusted Execution Environment. And this thing is on modern smartphones mostly used for DRM, stuff like Netflix with White Vine and all that kind of stuff, which decrypts encrypted video feeds. They hide keys in there so that you, as a pirate, cannot gain access to these keys and decrypt the video streams that you might get in 4K resolution from Netflix. They're using this for other stuff as well. Some security features, I think Samsung does this for secure key storage, all that kind of stuff. And I figured that I would just run this SIM card in this special mode. The memory or parts of the memory and certain devices like a serial port reader that would communicate with the SIM card, all that kind of stuff, you can assign this exclusively to the secure world. So even if you want to, from the normal world, you would be able to access that. You can't because the hardware would prohibit accesses to this stuff from the normal world and only from the secure world. In the secure world, I'm using a secure kernel called Opti. That's an open source project, which is a runtime environment for the trusted execution environment. And you could load you can load so-called trustlets in there. The trustlets are applications running in the trust zone. The SIM card is just one trustlet that you can load, and then you have a defined interface using some companion daemon on the Linux, which can forward data from the normal world in Linux user space over to the trust zone. You can get responses back and so on. So I built this API. The API was pretty easy. Send an APU, receive something back. That was the only API endpoint I had to implement because that's a normal SIM card interface. The trustlets can access parts of the Linux file system using this companion daemon, and the files in the Linux file system are encrypted. So, and the key is stored securely in the secure world. You can get it. You could get the SIM card files from that target that you just popped the shell on, but you couldn't read them because you don't have the key. And the SIM JSON that I showed earlier is just in this encrypted file system, and only the trustlet can access this. The challenge text to the second stage was, after you compromise the phone, you need to dig deeper. There is a flag on the SIM card in file 0x4333, which you need to get. So we can talk to the SIM card now because we popped the shell. We can't replace the trustlet because that's signed. We can't just add our own trustlet there, which would open the file, read it out, and present it to us, because we can't load it because we don't have the private key. The trustlet is not encrypted, though. I'm not sure if it's optional. You could certainly build it and encrypt it, but in this case, it's not encrypted. So we can grab the binary, throw it into a disassembler, and see how it works. Usually, you would spend a night doing this. I just copy and pasted code that I wrote onto the slides just to give you an idea how you would go through the code and find the bug. So we need to open a file. I implemented a C program that opens the interface and sends an APDU to select and read file 0x4333. Here you can see what an APDU looks like typically. First, we are selecting the file. We're sending 7 bytes. This is A0 is the class that is defined in GSM 11.11, so we want to do some GSM stuff. A4 is the select instruction. Then P0 and P2 is 0. That's by definition. O2 means length of the following data is 2 bytes, and then we have 2 bytes. That's the file ID. And we received back 2 status bytes. 0x9FOF means 9F means success, and I now have 15 bytes for you in response. That's the F. Then we are executing the get response call, which would hopefully give us which will give us some information about the file. We're sending the get response APDU with an expected length back from the SIM card of 15, because that's what we got here. We received back 17 bytes this time, because it's 15 bytes payload plus 2 bytes status report. That's SW1 and SW2. In this case, we got back some stuff and a success error code. So the stuff in here means this is the file len 0x2a, this is the file ID, and here is some information about the file. I think the access rights, all that kind of stuff. And then we are issuing a read request. We are receiving a length of, with we want to read a byte with a file with byte length 42. That's coincidence, by the way. We're sending the read request. We receive 2 bytes back, which in this case is an error code. So what does OX98 OX40A mean? This is from the spec. It means access condition not fulfilled. It's a security management error. Access condition not fulfilled. Unsuccessful CHV verification. At least one attempt left. Unsuccessful unblock CHV verification. At least one attempt left. Or authentication failed. So we're not verifying a CHV. We're not unblocking a CHV. And authentication failed. We don't care. So access condition is not fulfilled. The PIN was entered by the user of the phone we just pwned. The CHV1. So we can conclude that we need to verify CHV2, but we don't have that. We need to enter the PIN2 to access that file. So now we need to reverse engineer what's going on in the SIM card and find if we can somehow bypass that authentication. If we are trying to read a binary file from the SIM card, that's the appropriate code with some debug output. I left that debug output in there so that teams who disassemble that stuff can have some pointers what they're looking at. That's a nice trick. If you see an error message and it says somewhere access byte not sufficient in an if clause, then most likely this function checks the access conditions. So we're checking if we have a file selected, is there even a file open right now? If not, we're replying with an error. Are we allowed to access this? If not, we reply with an application, a security application error. Otherwise, we are checking if that is an elementary file because you cannot read directories, all that kind of stuff, and it goes on and on and on and on. So file access allowed. This is most likely where we are running into problems. This lengthy function is the verify CHV command. This is what you would do if you would enter a PIN. This would be called. Util-sim prepare is just a weird function. If you have 0 bytes in a PIN, so it means the PIN is it's the end of the PIN, it's replaced with OXFF. This function just replaces OXFF with 0 bytes so that you have a normal ASCII string. It might also be BCD encoded, something weird. That util-sim prepare thing just makes an ASCII string out of the PIN. We're checking if we either want to verify CHV1 or CHV2. We're checking if it's enabled. If it's not enabled, that operation always succeeds. If the JSON is wrong, we're replying with an internal error, and then we're calling chvverify. If chvverify returns success, we also return a success to the user. So what's this function doing? And that's, by the way, the way you would reverse engineer that as well. You would try to find the handler of that chvverification function, and then you would dig deeper and deeper and deeper into the places where that chv is actually compared to the one that's stored on the SIM card. CHV verify does not much. It's just a wrapper function around JSON formatting stuff. So we dig into this function. After that, this does some JSON parsing. So it checks if the remaining counts we can enter the PIN is 0. If that's 0, bad luck. We return that the PIN is blocked. Otherwise, we are comparing the PIN we got from the JSON object here to the stuff we supplied in the parameters. And we're using sir and compare for that. Where's the bug? By the way, Intel did this as well, I think. We control CHV val, which is passed from the user to the SIM card. If we just give it an empty string, this strn compare will compare 0 bytes of string length. And because every string starts with the empty string, this check will succeed. So if we just send an empty PIN, this authentication will be bypassed. The thing is, you can't do this over the phone UI. The phone UI expects you to enter at least 4 digits, because that's how phones work. But if we give it the empty string, then that authentication succeeds, and that's what I'm doing here. It's the same stuff where below here is, again, select, getting the response with the file length and reading the length. And here we are verifying an empty CHV2. A0 is, again, the class that we are sending to the SIM card. 20 is the command to verify the the CHV. 2 means we want to verify CHV2, and then we have a length, and we have all Fs, which means nothing. It's the pin is empty. And a correct SIM card would reject this, because I think by specification it needs to be at least 4 characters or 4 digits. But this is not a correct SIM card. So this will succeed, and we get a response code back of 9000, which means success. That now we authenticated, we have the access rights for CHV2, and then we can read out the flag. And this is the OX2C bytes here that we received back, and this is the admin, ASCII representation. This would be the flag if you're looking for. I have a demo for that. That's why I left the shells open. We still have that shell. What you would do now is you would write the C program. You would compile this in this development environment I gave to the teams, and just copy that over. You have wget, that was nice. You can just start an HTTP server. You can just start an HTTP server, and then you would do this on some public host on the Congress. That's easy, because you just get a public IP address. Oh, you're right. Sorry. Here. Okay. There's no tab completion because the terminal is messed up. And that worked. Yeah. That was the second stage. And with that, you solved the challenge, and you owned a GSM phone. I would like to thank the Osmocom contributors, all of them, because without them, I wouldn't have been able to implement that. And the experience of building that was actually quite fun, even though it was a bit stressful. Especially Vadim Janitsky, who is a contributor to Osmocom and Osmocom BB, he helped me. I wanted to get voice calls running, and I bothered him a bit on IRC and on the mailing lists, and he helped me. But in the end, I had to ditch that, because it just wouldn't work in the environment, and I personally wasn't able to make it work. And Niklas, team member who helped me writing the ROP chain, because without him, I would have gone crazy. Source code is available if you're interested in that stuff, want to set up your own virtual GSM network, run the code, do whatever with the code, feel free. In retrospective, the challenge could have been way cooler with, I don't know, stealing secrets from a SIM card and decrypting encrypted voice calls after that and so on. But I ran out of time. And also, as I said, Teams only had 48 hours. And the setup was already quite cumbersome. You had to have all these Docker containers with the base station in there, and the QMU, and the Osmocom BB. And if you never used something like that, that was challenging. But if people solved it, I think three teams solved the first stage, and one or two solved the second one. So And thanks to all the teams who played and put up with my shit. Any questions?
Do you have slides available?
I can share them, yes.
That would be nice. Thank you.
On Twitter or wherever. I'm just going to drop them.
All right. Thank you.
Talk. I have one question. Given the situation that you hacked a lot of stuff, did the team solve the challenge as intended?
Yes. Yep. As far as I know, I don't have any unintended bugs in there, but even if there are unintended bugs, it's part of the game. We also solved challenges in the past where there was some oversight, some misconfiguration. We also had that happen to us where, I don't know, pass WD-L under Debian does for the root password does something different than on Ubuntu, and suddenly you have no root password and you can log in without a password. Stuff like that. It always happens that you have unintended bugs, or sometimes it happens that you have unintended bugs, and that's part of the game. But that was not the case. Yeah. Thank you.